from the land. I am the immigrant clutching the hope I seek, and finding only the same old stupid plan of dog-eat-dog, of mighty-crush-the-weak. Oh, let America be America again, the land that never has been yet, and yet must be the land where every man is free, the land that's mine, the poor man's, Indians, Negroes, me, who made America, whose sweat and blood, whose faith and pain, whose hand at the foundry, whose plow in the rain, must bring back our mighty dream again. Sure, call me any ugly name you choose, the steel of freedom does not stain. From those who live like leeches on the people's lives, we must take back our land again. America. To white Americans of the 30s, however, North and South, blacks were invisible. Only the radicals made an attempt to break the racial barriers, socialists, Trotskyists, communists, most of all. The CIO, influenced by the communists, was organizing blacks in the mass production industries. Blacks were still being used as strikebreakers, but now there were also attempts to bring blacks and whites together against their common enemy. A woman named Molly Lewis, writing in The Crisis in 1938, told of her experience in a steel strike in Gary, Indiana. While the municipal government of Gary continues to keep the children apart in a system of separate schools, their parents are getting together in the union and in the auxiliary. The only public eating place in Gary, where both races may be freely served, is a cooperative restaurant largely patronized by members of the union and auxiliary. When the black and white workers and members of their families are convinced that their basic economic interests are the same, they may be expected to make common cause for the advancement of these interests. There was no great feminist movement in the 30s, but many women became involved in the labor organizing of those years. A Minnesota poet, Meridelle LeSueur, was 34 when the great Teamster strike tied up Minneapolis in 1934. She became active in it and later described her experiences. "I have never been in a strike before. The truth is, I was afraid. Do you need any help?" I said eagerly. We kept on pouring thousands of cups of coffee, feeding thousands of men. The cars were coming back. The announcer cried, "This is murder!" I saw them taking men out of cars and putting them on the hospital cots on the floor. The picket cars kept coming in. Some men have walked back from the market holding their own blood in. Men, women, and children are massing outside, a living circle close packed for protection. We have living blood on our skirts. Tuesday, the day of the funeral, 1,000 more militia were massed downtown. It was over 90 in the shade. I went to the funeral parlors, and thousands of men and women were massed there, waiting in the terrific sun. One block of women and children were standing 2 hours waiting. I went over and stood near them. I didn't know whether I could march. I didn't like marching in parades. 3 women drew me in. "We want all to march," they said gently. "Come with us." Sylvia Woods spoke to Allison Staunton Lind years later about her experiences in the 30s as a laundry worker and union organizer. "You have to tell people things they can see. Then they'll say, 'Oh, I never thought of that,' or 'I have never seen it like that.' Like Tennessee. He hated black people, a poor sharecropper. He danced with a black woman. So I have seen people change. This is the faith you've got to have in people." Many Americans began to change their thinking in those days of crisis and rebellion. In Europe, Hitler was on the march. Across the Pacific, Japan was invading China. The Western empires were being threatened by new ones. For the United States, war was not far off. Chapter 16. A People's War? We, the governments of Great Britain and the United States, in the name of India, Burma, Malaya, Australia, British East Africa, British Guinea, Hong Kong, Siam, Singapore, Egypt, Palestine, Canada, New Zealand, Northern Ireland, Scotland, Wales, as well as Puerto Rico, Guam, the Philippines, Hawaii, Alaska, and the Virgin Islands, hereby declare most emphatically that this is not an imperialist war. Thus went a skit put on in the United States in the year 1939 by the Communist Party. 2 years later, Germany invaded Soviet Russia, and the American Communist Party, which had repeatedly described the war between the Axis powers and the Allied powers as an imperialist war, now called it a people's war against fascism. Indeed, almost all Americans were now in agreement. Capitalists, communists, Democrats, Republicans, poor, rich, and middle class, that this was indeed a people's war. Was it? By certain evidence, it was the most popular war the United States had ever fought. Never had a greater proportion of the country participated in a war. 18 million served in the armed forces, 10 million overseas, 25 million workers gave of their pay envelope regularly for war bonds. But could this be considered a manufactured support, since all the power of the nation, not only of the government, but the press, the church, and even the chief radical organizations, was behind the calls for all-out war? Was there an undercurrent of reluctance? Were there unpublicized signs of resistance? It was a war against an enemy of unspeakable evil. Hitler's Germany was extending totalitarianism, racism, militarism, and overt aggressive warfare beyond what an already cynical world had experienced. And yet, did the governments conducting this war, England, the United States, the Soviet Union, represent something significantly different so that their victory would be a blow to imperialism, racism, totalitarianism, militarism in the world? Would the behavior of the United States during the war, in military action abroad, in treatment of minorities at home, be in keeping with a people's war? Would the country's wartime policies respect the rights of ordinary people everywhere to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? And would post-war America, in its policies at home and overseas, exemplify the values for which the war was supposed to have been fought? These questions deserve thought. At the time of World War II, the atmosphere was too dense with war fervor to permit them to be aired. For the United States to step forward as a defender of helpless countries matched its image in American high school history textbooks, but not its record in world affairs. It had opposed the Haitian Revolution for independence from France at the start of the 19th century. It had instigated a war with Mexico and taken half of that country. It had pretended to help Cuba win freedom from Spain, and then planted itself in Cuba with a military base, investments, and rights of intervention. It had seized Hawaii, Puerto Rico, Guam, and fought a brutal war to subjugate the Filipinos. It had opened Japan to its trade with gunboats and threats. It had declared an open-door policy in China as a means of assuring that the United States would have opportunities equal to other imperial powers in exploiting China. It had sent troops to Peking with other nations to assert Western supremacy in China and kept them there for over 30 years. While demanding an open door in China, it had insisted, with the Monroe Doctrine and many military interventions, on a closed door in Latin America, that is, closed to everyone but the United States. It had engineered a revolution against Colombia and created the independent state of Panama in order to build and control the canal. It sent 5,000 Marines to Nicaragua in 1926 to counter a revolution and kept a force there for 7 years. It intervened in the Dominican Republic for the fourth time in 1916 and kept troops there for 8 years. It intervened for the second time in Haiti in 1915 and kept troops there for 19 years. Between 1900 and 1933, The United States intervened in Cuba 4 times, in Nicaragua 2x, in Panama 6 times, in Guatemala 1x, in Honduras 7 times. By 1924, the finances of half of the 20 Latin American states were being directed to some extent by the United States. By 1935, over half of U.S. steel and cotton exports were being sold in Latin America. Just before World War I ended in 1918, an American force of 7,000 landed at Vladivostok as part of an Allied intervention in Russia and remained until early 1920. 5,000 more troops were landed at Archangel, another Russian port, also as part of an Allied expeditionary force, and stayed for almost a year. The State Department told Congress, "All these operations were to offset effects of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia." In short, if the entrance of the United States into World War II was, as so many Americans believed at the time, observing the Nazi invasions, to defend the principle of non-intervention in the affairs of other countries, the nation's record casts doubt on its ability to uphold that principle. What seemed clear at the time was that the United States was a democracy with certain liberties, while Germany was a dictatorship persecuting its Jewish minority, imprisoning dissidents, whatever their religion, while proclaiming the supremacy of the Nordic race. However, blacks, looking at anti-Semitism in Germany, might not see their own situation in the U.S. as much different. And the United States had done little about Hitler's policies of persecution. Indeed, it had joined England and France in appeasing Hitler throughout the 30s. Roosevelt and his Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, were hesitant to criticize publicly Hitler's anti-Semitic policies. When a resolution was introduced in the Senate in January 1934, asking the Senate and the President to express surprise and pain at what the Germans were doing to the Jews and to ask restoration of Jewish rights, the State Department caused this resolution to be buried in committee, according to Arnold Offner, American Appeasement. When Mussolini's Italy invaded Ethiopia in 1935, the U.S. declared an embargo on munitions, but let American businesses send oil to Italy in huge quantities, which was essential to Italy's carrying on the war. When a fascist rebellion took place in Spain in 1936 against the elected socialist liberal government, the Roosevelt administration sponsored a neutrality act that had the effect of shutting off help to the Spanish government, while Hitler and Mussolini gave critical aid to Franco. Offner says, "The United States went beyond even the legal requirements of its neutrality legislation. Had aid been forthcoming from the United States and from England and France, considering that Hitler's position on aid to Franco was not firm at least until November 1936, the Spanish Republicans could well have triumphed. Instead, Germany gained every advantage from the Spanish Civil War." Was this simply poor judgment, an unfortunate error? Or was it the logical policy of a government whose main interest was not stopping fascism, but advancing the imperial interests of the United States? For those interests, in the 30s, an anti-Soviet policy seemed best. Later, when Japan and Germany threatened U.S. world interests, a pro-Soviet anti-Nazi policy became preferable. Roosevelt was as much concerned to end the oppression of Jews as Lincoln was to end slavery during the Civil War. Their priority in policy, whatever their personal compassion for victims of persecution, was not minority rights, but national power. It was not Hitler's attacks on the Jews that brought the United States into World War II, any more than the enslavement of 4 million blacks brought civil war in 1861. Italy's attack on Ethiopia, Hitler's invasion of Austria, his takeover of Czechoslovakia, his attack on Poland, none of those events caused the United States to enter the war, although Roosevelt did begin to give important aid to England. What brought the United States fully into the war was the Japanese attack on the American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, on December 7, 1941. Surely it was not the humane concern for Japan's bombing of civilians that led to Roosevelt's outraged call for war. Japan's attack on China in 1937, her bombing of civilians at Nanking, had not provoked the United States to war. It was the Japanese attack on a link in the American Pacific Empire that did it. So long as Japan remained a well-behaved member of that imperial club of great powers, who, in keeping with the open-door policy, were sharing the exploitation of China, the United States did not object. It had exchanged notes with Japan in 1917 saying, "The government of the United States recognizes that Japan has special interests in China." In 1928, according to Akira Arie, after imperialism, American consuls in China supported the coming of Japanese troops. It was when Japan threatened potential U.S. markets by its attempted takeover of China, but especially as it moved toward the tin, rubber, and oil of Southeast Asia, that the United States became alarmed and took those measures which led to the Japanese attack. A total embargo on scrap iron, a total embargo on oil in the summer of 1941. As Bruce Russett says, "No clear and present danger." Throughout the 1930s, the United States government had done little to resist the Japanese advance on the Asian continent. But the Southwest Pacific area was of undeniable economic importance to the United States. At the time, most of America's tin and rubber came from there, as did substantial quantities of other raw materials. Pearl Harbor was presented to the American public as a sudden, shocking, immoral act. Immoral it was, like any bombing, but not really sudden or shocking to the American government. Russett says, "Japan's strike against the American naval base climaxed a long series of mutually antagonistic acts. In initiating economic sanctions against Japan, the United States undertook actions that were widely recognized in Washington as carrying grave risks of war." Putting aside the wild accusations against Roosevelt, that he knew about Pearl Harbor and didn't tell, or that he deliberately provoked the Pearl Harbor raid, these are without evidence. It does seem clear that he did as James Polk had done before him in the Mexican War, and Lyndon Johnson after him in the Vietnam War. He lied to the public for what he thought was a right cause. In September and October 1941, he misstated the facts in two incidents involving German submarines and American destroyers. A historian sympathetic to Roosevelt, Thomas A. Bailey, has written, "Franklin Roosevelt repeatedly deceived the American people during the period before Pearl Harbor. He was like the physician who must tell the patient lies for the patient's own good. Because the masses are notoriously short-sighted and generally cannot see danger until it is at their throats." One of the judges in the Tokyo War Crimes Trial after World War II, Radabinod Pal, dissented from the general verdicts against Japanese officials and argued that the United States had clearly provoked the war with Japan and expected Japan to act. Richard Minear, Victor's justice, sums up Powell's view of the embargoes on scrap iron and oil, that these measures were a clear and potent threat to Japan's very existence. The records show that a White House conference 2 weeks before Pearl Harbor anticipated a war and discussed how it should be justified. A State Department memorandum on Japanese expansion a year before Pearl Harbor did not talk of the independence of China or the principle of self-determination. It said, Our general diplomatic and strategic position would be considerably weakened by our loss of Chinese, Indian, and South Seas markets, and by our loss of much of the Japanese market for our goods, as Japan would become more and more self-sufficient, as well as by insurmountable restrictions upon our access to the rubber, tin, jute, and other vital materials of the Asian and Oceanic regions. Once joined with England and Russia in the war, Germany and Italy declared war on the United States right after Pearl Harbor. Did the behavior of the United States show that her war aims were humanitarian or centered on power and profit? Was she fighting the war to end the control by some nations over others, or to make sure the controlling nations were friends of the United States? In August 1941, Roosevelt and Churchill met off the coast of Newfoundland and released to the world the Atlantic Charter, setting forth noble goals for the post-war world, saying their countries seek no aggrandizement, territorial or other, and that they respected the right of all peoples to choose the form of government under which they will live. The Charter was celebrated as declaring the rights of nations to self-determination. 2 weeks before the Atlantic Charter, however, the U.S. Acting Secretary of State, Sumner Welles, had assured the French government that they could keep their empire intact after the end of the war. This government, mindful of its traditional friendship for France, has deeply sympathized with the desire of the French people to maintain their territories and to preserve them intact. The Department of Defense History of Vietnam, the Pentagon Papers, itself pointed to what it called an ambivalent policy toward Indochina, noting that in the Atlantic Charter and other pronouncements, the U.S. proclaimed support for national self-determination and independence, but also, early in the war, repeatedly expressed or implied to the French an intention to restore to France its overseas empire after the war. In late 1942, Roosevelt's personal representative assured French General Henri Girard, "It is thoroughly understood that French sovereignty will be reestablished as soon as possible throughout all the territory, metropolitan or colonial, over which flew the French flag in 1939. These pages, like the others in the Pentagon Papers, are marked top secret, sensitive. By 1945, the ambivalent attitude was gone. In May, Truman assured the French he did not question her sovereignty over Indochina. That fall, the United States urged nationalist China, put temporarily in charge of the northern part of Indochina by the Potsdam Conference, to turn it over to the French, despite the obvious desire of the Vietnamese for independence. That was a favor for the French government. But what about the United States' own imperial ambitions during the war? What about the aggrandizement, territorial or other, that Roosevelt had renounced in the Atlantic Charter? In the headlines were the battles and troop movements, the invasion of North Africa in 1942, Italy in 1943, the massive, dramatic cross-channel invasion of German-occupied France in 1944, the bitter battles as Germany was pushed back toward and over her frontiers, the increasing bombardment by the British and American air forces, and at the same time the Russian victories over the Nazi armies. The Russians, by the time of the cross-channel invasion, had driven the Germans out of Russia and were engaging 80% of the German troops. In the Pacific, in 1943 and 1944, there was the island-by-island move of American forces toward Japan, finding closer and closer bases for the thunderous bombardment of Japanese cities. Quietly, behind the headlines in battles and bombings, American diplomats and businessmen worked hard to make sure that when the war ended, American economic power would be second to none in the world. United States business would penetrate areas that up to this time had been dominated by England. The open-door policy of equal access would be extended from Asia to Europe, meaning that the United States intended to push England aside and move in. That is what happened to the Middle East and its oil. In August 1945, a State Department officer said that a review of the diplomatic history of the past 35 years will show that petroleum has historically played a larger part in the external relations of the United States than any other commodity. Saudi Arabia was the largest oil pool in the Middle East. The Aramco Oil Corporation, through Secretary of the Interior Harold Ickes, got Roosevelt to agree to lend-lease aid to Saudi Arabia, which would involve the U.S. government there and create a shield for the interests of Aramco. In 1944, Britain and the U.S. signed a pact on oil, agreeing on the principle of equal opportunity. And Lloyd Gardner concludes, Economic Aspects of New Deal Diplomacy, that the open-door policy was triumphant throughout the Middle East. Historian Gabriel Kolko, after a close study of American wartime policy, the politics of war, concludes that the American economic war aim was to save capitalism at home and abroad. In April 1944, a State Department official said, "As you know, we've got to plan on enormously increased production in this country after the war, and the American domestic market can't absorb all that production indefinitely. There won't be any question about our needing greatly increased foreign markets." Anthony Sampson, in his study of the international oil business, The Seven Sisters, says, "By the end of the war, the dominant influence in Saudi Arabia was unquestionably the United States. King Ibn Saud was regarded no longer as a wild desert warrior, but as a key piece in the power game to be wooed by the West. Roosevelt, on his way back from Yalta in February 1945, entertained the king on the cruiser Quincy, together with his entourage of 50, including two sons, a prime minister, an astrologer, and flocks of sheep for slaughter. Roosevelt then wrote to Ibn Saud, promising the United States would not change its Palestine policy without consulting the Arabs. In later years, the concern for oil would constantly compete with political concern for the Jewish state in the Middle East. But at this point, oil seemed more important. With British imperial power collapsing during World War II, the United States was ready to move in. Hull said early in the war, "Leadership toward a new system of international relationships and trade and other economic affairs will devolve very largely upon the United States because of our great economic strength. We should assume this leadership and the responsibility that goes with it, primarily for reasons of pure national self-interest." Before the war was over, the administration was planning the outlines of the new international economic order based on partnership between government and big business. Lloyd Gardner says of Roosevelt's chief advisor, Harry Hopkins, who had organized the relief programs of the New Deal, "No conservative outdid Hopkins in championing foreign investment and its protection." The poet Archibald MacLeish, then an assistant secretary of state, spoke critically of what he saw in the post-war world. "As things are now going, the peace we will make, the peace we seem to be making, will be a piece of oil, a piece of gold, a piece of shipping, a piece, in brief, without moral purpose or human interest." During the war, England and the United States set up the International Monetary Fund to regulate international exchanges of currency. Voting would be proportional to capital contributed, so American dominance would be assured. The International Bank for Reconstruction and Development was set up, supposedly to help reconstruct war-destroyed areas, but one of its first objectives was, in its own words, to promote foreign investment. The economic aid countries would need after the war was already seen in political terms. Averell Harriman, ambassador to Russia, said in early 1944, "Economic assistance is one of the most effective weapons at our disposal to influence European political events in the direction we desire." The creation of the United Nations during the war was presented to the world as international cooperation to prevent future wars. But the UN was dominated by the Western imperial countries, the United States, England, and France, and a new imperial power with military bases and powerful influence in Eastern Europe, the Soviet Union. An important conservative Republican senator, Arthur Vandenberg, wrote in his diary about the United Nations Charter, "The striking thing about it is that it is so conservative from a nationalist standpoint. It is based virtually on a four-power alliance. This is anything but a wild-eyed internationalist dream of a world state. I am deeply impressed and surprised to find Hull so carefully guarding our American veto in his scheme of things." The plights of Jews in German-occupied Europe, which many people thought was at the heart of the war against the Axis, was not a chief concern of Roosevelt. Henry Feingold's research, The Politics of Rescue, shows that while the Jews were being put in camps and the process of annihilation was beginning that would end in the horrifying extermination of 6 million Jews and millions of non-Jews, Roosevelt failed to take steps that might have saved thousands of lives. He did not see it as a high priority. He left it to the State Department. And in the State Department, anti-Semitism and a cold bureaucracy became obstacles to action. Was the war being fought to establish that Hitler was wrong in his ideas of white Nordic supremacy over inferior races? The United States armed forces were segregated by race. When troops were jammed onto the Queen Mary in early 1945 to go to combat duty in the European theater, the blacks were stowed down in the depths of the ship near the engine room, as far as possible from the fresh air of the deck, in a bizarre reminder of the slave voyages of old. The Red Cross, with government approval, separated the blood donations of black and white. It was, ironically, a black physician named Charles Drew who developed the blood bank system. He was put in charge of the wartime donations and then fired when he tried to end blood segregation. Despite the urgent need for wartime labor, blacks were still being discriminated against for jobs. A spokesman for a West Coast aviation plant said, "The Negro will be considered only as janitors and in other similar capacities. Regardless of their training as aircraft workers, we will not employ them." Roosevelt never did anything to enforce the orders of the Fair Employment Practices Commission he had set up. The fascist nations were notorious in their insistence that the woman's place was in the home. Yet the war against fascism, although it utilized women in defense industries where they were desperately needed, took no special steps to change the subordinate role of women. The War Manpower Commission, despite the large numbers of women in war work, kept women off its policy-making bodies. A report of the Women's Bureau of the Department of Labor by its director, Mary Anderson, said, "The War Manpower Commission had doubts and uneasiness about what was then regarded as a developing attitude of militancy or a crusading spirit on the part of women leaders." In one of its policies, the United States came close to direct duplication of fascism. This was in its treatment of the Japanese Americans living on the West Coast. After the Pearl Harbor attack, anti-Japanese hysteria spread in the government. One congressman said, "I'm for catching every Japanese in America, Alaska, and Hawaii now and putting them in concentration camps. Damn them. Let's get rid of them." Franklin D. Roosevelt did not share this frenzy, but he calmly signed Executive Order 9066 in February 1942, giving the Army the power, without warrants or indictments or hearings, to arrest every Japanese American on the West Coast, 110,000 men, women, and children, to take them from their homes, transport them to camps far into the interior, and keep them there under prison conditions. 3/4 of these were Nisei, children born in the United States of Japanese parents, and therefore American citizens. The other 1/4, the Issei, born in Japan, were barred by law from becoming citizens. In 1944, the Supreme Court upheld the forced evacuation on the grounds of military necessity. The Japanese remained in those camps for over 3 years. Michi Weglin was a young girl when her family experienced evacuation and detention. She tells, in years of infamy, of bungling in the evacuation, of misery, confusion, anger, but also of Japanese-American dignity and fighting back. There were strikes, petitions, mass meetings, refusal to sign loyalty oaths, riots against the camp authorities. The Japanese resisted to the end. Not until after the war did the story of the Japanese-Americans begin to be known to the general public. The month the war ended in Asia, September 1945, an article appeared in Harper's Magazine by Yale law professor Eugene V. Rostow, calling the Japanese evacuation our worst wartime mistake. Was it a mistake, or was it an action to be expected from a nation with a long history of racism and which was fighting a war not to end racism, but to retain the fundamental elements of the American system? It was a war waged by a government whose chief beneficiary, despite volumes of reforms, was a wealthy elite. The alliance between big business and the government went back to the very first proposals of Alexander Hamilton to Congress after the Revolutionary War. By World War II, that partnership had developed and intensified. During the Depression, Roosevelt had once denounced the economic royalists, but he always had the support of certain important business leaders. During the war, as Bruce Catton saw it from his post in the War Production Board, the economic royalists, denounced and derided, had a part to play now. Catton, the warlords of Washington, described the process of industrial mobilization to carry on the war, and how, in this process, wealth became more and more concentrated in fewer and fewer large corporations. In 1940, the United States had begun sending large amounts of war supplies to England and France. By 1941, 3/4 of the value of military contracts were handled by 56 large corporations. A Senate report, Economic Concentration and World War II, noted that the government contracted for scientific research and industry during the war, and although 2,000 corporations were involved, of $1 billion spent, $400 million went to 10 large corporations. Management remained firmly in charge of decision-making during the war, and although 12 million workers were organized in the CIO and AFL, labor was in a subordinate position. Labor management committees were set up in 5,000 factories as a gesture toward industrial democracy, but they acted mostly as disciplinary groups for absentee workers and devices for increasing production. Catton writes, "The big operators who made the working decisions had decided that nothing very substantial was going to be changed." Despite the overwhelming atmosphere of patriotism and total dedication to winning the war, despite the no-strike pledges of the AFL and CIO, many of the nation's workers, frustrated by the freezing of wages while business profits rocketed skyward, went on strike. During the war, there were 14,000 strikes involving 6,770,000 workers, more than in any comparable period in American history. In 1944 alone, 1 million workers went on strike, in the mines, in the steel mills, in the auto and transportation equipment industries. When the war ended, the strikes continued in record numbers. 3 million on strike in the first half of 1946. According to Jeremy Brecker, strike. If not for the disciplinary hand of the unions, there might have been a general confrontation between the workers of a great many industries and the government supporting the employers. In Lowell, Massachusetts, for example, according to an unpublished manuscript by Mark Miller, The Irony of Victory, Lowell During World War II, there were as many strikes in 1943 and 1944 as in 1937. It may have been a people's war, but here was dissatisfaction at the fact that the textile mill profits grew 600% from 1940 to 1946, while wage increases in cotton goods industries went up 36%. How little the war changed the difficult condition of women workers is shown by the fact that in Lowell, among women war workers with children, only 5% could have their children taken care of by nursery schools. The others had to make their own arrangements. Beneath the noise of enthusiastic patriotism, there were many people who thought war was wrong, even in the circumstances of fascist aggression. Out of 10 million drafted for the armed forces during World War II, only 43,000 refused to fight. But this was three times the proportion of conscientious objectors in World War I. Of these 43,000, about 6,000 went to prison, which was proportionately four times the number of COs who went to prison during World War I. Of every six men in federal prison, one was there as a CO. Many more than 43,000 refusers did not show up for the draft at all. The government lists about 350,000 cases of draft evasion, including technical violations as well as actual desertion. So it is hard to tell the true number. But it may be that the number of men who either did not show up or claimed CO status was in the hundreds of thousands, not a small number. And this in the face of an American community almost unanimously for the war. Among those soldiers who were not conscientious objectors, who seemed willing fighters, it is hard to know how much resentment there was against authority, against having to fight in a war whose aims were unclear, inside a military machine whose lack of democracy was very clear. No one recorded the bitterness of enlisted men against the special privileges of officers in the army of a country known as a democracy. To give just one instance, combat crews in the Air Force in the European theater, going to the base movies between bombing missions, found two lines, an officer's line, short, and an enlisted men's line, very long. There were two mess halls, even as they prepared to go into combat. The enlisted men's food was different, worse, than the officers. The literature that followed World War II, James Jones' From Here to Eternity, Joseph Heller's Catch-22, and Norman Mailer's The Naked and the Dead, captured this GI anger against the army brass. In The Naked and the Dead, the soldiers talk in battle, and one of them says, "The only thing wrong with this army is it never lost a war." Tolio was shocked. "You think we ought to lose this one?" Red found himself carried away. "What have I against the goddamn Japs? You think I care if they keep this fucking jungle? What's it to me if Cummings gets another star?" "General Cummings, he's a good man," Martinez said. "There ain't a good officer in the world," Red stated. There seemed to be widespread indifference, even hostility, on the part of the Negro community to the war, despite the attempts of Negro newspapers and Negro leaders to mobilize black sentiment. Lawrence Whitner, Rebels Against War, quotes a black journalist, "The Negro is angry, resentful, and utterly apathetic about the war. Fight for what?" he is asking. "This war doesn't mean a thing to me. If we win, I lose. So what?" A black army officer, home on furlough, told friends in Harlem he had been in hundreds of bull sessions with Negro soldiers and found no interest in the war. A student at a Negro college told his teacher, "The army Jim Crows us. The Navy lets us serve only as messmen. The Red Cross refuses our blood. Employers and labor unions shut us out. Lynchings continue. We are disenfranchised, Jim Crowed, spat upon. What more could Hitler do than that? NAACP leader Walter White repeated this to a black audience of several thousand people in the Midwest, thinking they would disapprove, but instead, he recalled, to my surprise and dismay, the audience burst into such applause that it took me some 30 or 40 seconds to quiet it. In January 1943, there appeared in a Negro newspaper this draftee's prayer. Dear Lord, today I go to war, to fight, to die. Tell me, what for? Dear Lord, I'll fight. I do not fear Germans or Japs. My fears are here, a miracle. But there was no organized Negro opposition to the war. In fact, there was little organized opposition from any source. The Communist Party was enthusiastically in support. The Socialist Party was divided, unable to make a clear statement one way or the other. A few small anarchist and pacifist groups refused to back the war. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom said, "War between nations or classes or races cannot permanently settle conflicts or heal the wounds that brought them into being." The Catholic Worker wrote, "We are still pacifists." The difficulty of merely calling for peace in a world of capitalism, fascism, communism, dynamic ideologies, aggressive actions, troubled some pacifists. They began to speak of revolutionary nonviolence. A.J. Mustey of the Fellowship of Reconciliation said in later years, "I was not impressed with the sentimental, easygoing pacifism of the early part of the century. People then felt that if they sat and talked pleasantly of peace and love, they would solve the problems of the world." The world was in the midst of a revolution, Mustey realized, and those against violence must take revolutionary action, but without violence. A movement of revolutionary pacifism would have to make effective contacts with oppressed and minority groups such as Negroes, sharecroppers, industrial workers. Only one organized socialist group opposed the war unequivocally. This was the Socialist Workers' Party. The Espionage Act of 1917, still on the books, applied to wartime statements. But in 1940, with the United States not yet at war, Congress passed the Smith Act. This took Espionage Act prohibitions against talk or writing that would lead to refusal of duty in the armed forces and applied them to peacetime. The Smith Act also made it a crime to advocate the overthrow of the government by force and violence, or to join any group that advocated this, or to publish anything with such ideas. In Minneapolis in 1943, 18 members of the Socialist Workers' Party were convicted for belonging to a party whose ideas, expressed in its Declaration of Principles and in the Communist Manifesto, were said to violate the Smith Act. They were sentenced to prison terms, and the Supreme Court refused to review their case. A few voices continued to insist that the real war was inside each nation. Dwight MacDonald's wartime magazine, Politics, presented in early 1945 an article by the French worker philosopher Simone Weil. Whether the mask is labeled fascism, democracy, or a dictatorship of the proletariat, our great adversary remains the apparatus, the bureaucracy, the police, the military. Not the one facing us across the frontier or the battle lines, which is not so much our enemy as our brother's enemy, but the one that calls itself our protector and makes us its slaves. No matter what the circumstances, the worst betrayal will always be to subordinate ourselves to this apparatus and to trample underfoot in its service all human values in ourselves and in others. Still, the vast bulk of the American population was mobilized in the army and in civilian life to fight the war, and the atmosphere of war enveloped more and more Americans. Public opinion polls show large majorities of soldiers favoring the draft for the post-war period. Hatred against the enemy, against the Japanese particularly, became widespread. Racism was clearly at work. Time magazine, reporting the Battle of Iwo Jima, said, "The ordinary unreasoning Jap is ignorant. Perhaps he is human. Nothing indicates it." So there was a mass base of support for what became the heaviest bombardment of civilians ever undertaken in any war, the aerial attacks on German and Japanese cities. One might argue that this popular support made it a people's war. But if people's war means a war of people against attack, a defensive war, if it means a war fought for humane reasons instead of for the privileges of an elite, a war against the few, not the many, then the tactics of all-out aerial assault against the populations of Germany and Japan destroy that notion. Italy had bombed cities in the Ethiopian War. Italy and Germany had bombed civilians in the Spanish Civil War. At the start of World War II, German planes dropped bombs on Rotterdam in Holland, Coventry in England, and elsewhere. Roosevelt had described these as inhuman barbarism that has profoundly shocked the conscience of humanity. These German bombings were very small compared with the British and American bombings of German cities. In January 1943, the Allies met at Casablanca and agreed on large-scale air attacks to achieve the destruction and dislocation of the German military, industrial, and economic system, and the undermining of the morale of the German people to the point where their capacity for armed resistance is fatally weakened. And so, the saturation bombing of German cities began, with 1,000 plane raids on Cologne, Essen, Frankfurt, Hamburg. The English flew at night with no pretense of aiming at military targets. The Americans flew in the daytime and pretended precision, but bombing from high altitudes made that impossible. The climax of this terror bombing was the bombing of Dresden in early 1945, in which the tremendous heat generated by the bombs created a vacuum into which fire leaped swiftly in a great firestorm through the city. More than 100,000 died in Dresden. Winston Churchill, in his wartime memoirs, confined himself to this account of the incident. "We made a heavy raid in the latter month on Dresden, then a center of communication of Germany's Eastern Front. The bombing of Japanese cities continued the strategy of saturation bombing to destroy civilian morale. One nighttime firebombing of Tokyo took 80,000 lives. And then, on August 6, 1945, came the lone American plane in the sky over Hiroshima, dropping the first atomic bomb, leaving perhaps 100,000 Japanese dead and tens of thousands more slowly dying from radiation poisoning. 12 U.S. Navy flyers in the Hiroshima City Jail were killed in the bombing, a fact that the U.S. government has never officially acknowledged, according to historian Martin Sherwin, A World Destroyed. 3 days later, a second atomic bomb was dropped on the city of Nagasaki, with perhaps 50,000 killed. The justification for these atrocities was that this would end the war quickly, making unnecessary an invasion of Japan. Such an invasion would cost a huge number of lives, the government said. 1 million, according to Secretary of State Burns. 500,000, Truman claimed, was the figure given him by General George Marshall. When the papers of the Manhattan Project, the project to build the atom bomb, was released years later, they showed that Marshall urged a warning to the Japanese about the bomb, so people could be removed and only military targets hit. These estimates of invasion losses were not realistic and seemed to have been pulled out of the air to justify bombings, which, as their effects became known, horrified more and more people. Japan, by August 1945, was in desperate shape and ready to surrender. New York Times military analyst Hanson Baldwin wrote shortly after the war, The enemy, in a military sense, was in a hopeless strategic position by the time the Potsdam demand for unconditional surrender was made on July 26th. Such, then, was the situation when we wiped out Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Need we have done it? No one can, of course, be positive, but the answer is almost certainly negative. The United States Strategic Bombing Survey, set up by the War Department in 1944 to study the results of aerial attacks in the war, interviewed hundreds of Japanese civilian and military leaders after Japan surrendered and reported just after the war. Based on a detailed investigation of all the facts and supported by the testimony of the surviving Japanese leaders involved, it is the survey's opinion that certainly prior to 31st December 1945, and in all probability prior to 1st November 1945, Japan would have surrendered even if the atomic bombs had not been dropped, even if Russia had not entered the war, and even if no invasion had been planned or contemplated. But could American leaders have known this in August 1945? The answer is, clearly, yes. The Japanese code had been broken, and Japan's messages were being intercepted. It was known the Japanese had instructed their ambassador in Moscow to work on peace negotiations with the Allies. Japanese leaders had begun talking of surrender a year before this, and the emperor himself had begun to suggest in June 1945 that alternatives to fighting to the end be considered. On July 13th, Foreign Minister Shigenori Togo wired his ambassador in Moscow, "Unconditional surrender is the only obstacle to peace." Martin Sherwin, after an exhaustive study of the relevant historical documents, concludes, "Having broken the Japanese code before the war, American intelligence was able to, and did, relay this message to the president, but it had no effect whatever on efforts to bring the war to a conclusion." If only the Americans had not insisted on unconditional surrender, that is, if they were willing to accept one condition to the surrender, that the emperor, a holy figure to the Japanese, remain in place, the Japanese would have agreed to stop the war. Why did the United States not take that small step to save both American and Japanese lives? Was it because too much money and effort had been invested in the atomic bomb not to drop it? General Leslie Groves, head of the Manhattan Project, described Truman as a man on a toboggan, the momentum too great to stop it. Or was it as a British scientist, PMS Blackett, suggested, fear, war, and the bomb, that the United States was anxious to drop the bomb before the Russians entered the war against Japan? The Russians had secretly agreed, they were officially not at war with Japan, they would come into the war 90 days before the end of the European War. That turned out to be May 8th, and so on August 8th, the Russians were due to declare war on Japan. But by then, the big bomb had been dropped, and the next day, a second one would be dropped on Nagasaki. The Japanese would surrender to the United States, not the Russians, and the United States would be the occupier of post-war Japan. In other words, Blackett says, the dropping of the bomb was the first major operation of the cold diplomatic war with Russia. Blackett is supported by American historian Gar Alperowitz, Atomic Diplomacy, who notes a diary entry for July 28, 1945, by Secretary of the Navy James Forrestal, describing Secretary of State James F. Burns as most anxious to get the Japanese affair over with before the Russians got in. Truman had said, "The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. That was because we wished in this first attack to avoid, insofar as possible, the killings of civilians." It was a preposterous statement. Those 100,000 killed in Hiroshima were almost all civilians. The U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey said in its official report, "Hiroshima and Nagasaki were chosen as targets because of their concentration of activities and population." The dropping of the second bomb on Nagasaki seems to have been scheduled in advance, and no one has ever been able to explain why it was dropped. Was it because this was a plutonium bomb, whereas the Hiroshima bomb was a uranium bomb? Were the dead and irradiated of Nagasaki victims of a scientific experiment? Martin Sherwin says that among the Nagasaki dead were probably American prisoners of war. He notes a message of July 31st from headquarters, U.S. Army Strategic Air Forces, Guam, to the War Department. Reports prisoner of war sources, not verified by photos, give location of Allied prisoner of war camp 1 mile north of central.